The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
On Campus Voices today, we've got a farewell interview from Ben Yagoda, who retired from the teaching faculty here at the University of Delaware in December of 2016. Ben, you came here in 1992. It was back in the days when email was still hyphenated and internet was capitalized.
Those were the days.
And joining us in the studio also is one of Ben's students and an intern of mine over in my day job over in the University of Delaware Information Technologies, Rachel Curry. Rachel, you were present in Ben's last class for the university.
It was monumental.
You know, your sense of irony is I hope I had something to do with teaching you, but that was well played. It was very nice. It was really a great class. Both the class itself was one of my best ones, and the last session was really nice.
You have taught writing and journalism classes and at different times advised the review.
Writing, journalism, different forms, never fiction, never poetry, always nonfiction, but basically all different kinds imaginable of nonfiction. Right? Except I always wanted to teach English 110, which is freshman English. I always wanted to give that a shot.
How has language changed in your 24 years here?
Well, you know, the one thing that really comes to mind, not dramatically among student writing, students generally are pretty bright and have a pretty decent facility with language. But the biggest problem that I kind of felt at the get-go and still do is they don't really read that much, which is a little counterintuitive because they're always reading today, especially. And I think on the whole, with the internet and all the social media, Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, I think on the whole has been a good thing because it's a facility with writing and communicating and even keyboarding skills, but not so much reading books and not so much reading kind of real edited articles in the New Yorker and Harper's and New York Times and things like that. So even though they have a facility with language, that they miss out on, well, a lot of information, facts that you pick up by reading, things like punctuation that you pick up by reading. You can't just, study all the rules. And even spelling, even though spell check is, again, on the whole, has made spelling better in their documents, there are these things that spell check misses. And the one example that comes to mind is the past tense of the verb to lead, L-E-A-D. And the past tense, of course, is spelled?
L-E-D.
Exactly right. But that's an exception. The majority of times students do that, they spell it L-E-A-D. And spell check, of course, doesn't pick it up because it's a word. So things like that. The not so good trend in recent years, and I don't have a real reason for that, is a kind of faux formality. Sometimes for no reason I can imagine. So the popularity of the word amongst instead of among. Again, most students will choose amongst for reasons I can't fathom. It's
or whilst instead of while.
I had that once.
Oh, really?
I had one person use whilst, and I treasured that. But words like oftentimes instead of often, and sometimes using bigger words but incorrectly, which I think that's a thing that's been around all the time. But I think maybe the one wrinkle now is they want to get a fancy word, so they'll go to the online thesaurus and say, I'll pick that one. And it's really not the right word.
Rachel's an exception, but student writing really reflects what's happening in journalism overall. That is, the stories are getting shorter. They're more based on grabbing a headline.
Right. That idea of the short attention span, that the Twitter feed is the ultimate thing of that with 140 characters. Although, yeah, I write a column for the Chronicle of Higher Education for their blog Lingua Franca about writing and language, and my second and most recent piece was about how, I don't know if you've seen Twitter threads, this idea that people have a series of tweets because they can't encompass their idea into 140 characters. So they thread this one that I wrote about that got a lot of attention in early December by a guy named Eric Garland. He put together 130 tweets in a row, and it ended up being 2,800 words. We used to have a name for that, which was an essay. So he's kind of coming at it from a sort of odd place. See, all sorts of interesting things
But people
are happening.
Read all of those tweets, too, interesting because it's broken up.
You know, you see in tweet number 7 was sort of liked 800 times and retweeted 400. I feel more interesting and good writing going on now than probably ever before, just because of all the ways that people can write and actually publish their work, which when I was coming up as a writer, there were these small number of very stern gatekeepers. And if you didn't pass muster with them, no one could ever see your work. And now you can publish it yourself, and theoretically the whole world can see it. Now, getting paid for that is another story and much more difficult. So that's why it's good. I tell students that if they want to write, wonderful time, but it's important to have a day job or some source of income. Wanting to get your income and paid from writing is really hard now.
How did you decide to become a, quote, writer?
Well, it was sort of a process of elimination. So when I realized there was basically nothing else that I was any good at.
Oh, I think that's false modesty, sir.
Well, have you seen my management skills? It's pretty brutal. But no, I definitely felt I had an aptitude towards it. I think about that question a fair amount, and part of it is compensation, that I have a general state of confusion a lot of times, which I don't really like, about not knowing what I think about things. And writing is a great way to figure out what you think about it and, you know, revise it so you've said it in the best way you can. And that's, to me, a satisfying thing. And I write about writing and language a lot, so I tend to notice. It's just something that I'm attuned to, is words and language and writing. I guess starting in high school, I had that notion and kind of figuring out what sort of writing I was interested in. It ended up being journalism, which has evolved into writing books and essays. You know, it ended up being a good fit for me.
What's been your experience about what drives students to want to be writers? What drives students to want to be on the University of Delaware Review?
It's interesting. I definitely do want to hear Rachel's thought on that. Our journalism program at Delaware has grown pretty steadily from the time I was here, year by year, to now. And we now have a journalism minor, and each year it's a more and more popular minor. And there was a time, and that's a little puzzling because, as I said earlier, the writing and journalism industry is going through some really tough times. Getting jobs is really tough. Newspapers are sometimes folding and trimming their staffs. At one point, I'd sort of ask people, well, why are you doing that? And I think the answers were a little depressing. It was sort of like along the lines of, well, my mom thought I should study something practical. Now, why the mom thought that was practical, I don't know. But maybe compared to studying Milton and Shakespeare and Wordsworth, it was. Then there are a few people, and I think maybe, Rachel, you're one of them, who really sort of were like me and kind of had a sense that this is what I want to do. I've got some either passion or ability or interest or a combination of the above from an early age. And, you know, it is true that over the years, I've had a lot of really talented students, many of whom have gone on to do great things, and you're one of them. But is that something that you had been interested in from an early age?
I mean, yeah, and I think a lot of students in the writing program here also kind of feel the same way, as they've always been interested in writing. And I think that as the years progressed and as we go from high school to college, we've kind of honed our interest to be more, instead of wanting, you know, just to write a novel, we want to do all these other things with writing too, you know? So we've honed our interests a little bit, but what I see is that a lot of people have always been interested in writing, and it's a very, because of that, it's a very passionate program. Students getting involved in things like the Review or even things like the Main Street Journal.
Well, Main Street Journal is a more of a literary magazine, right? Because it's got fiction and, and literary essays and poetry. And Cesura is a similar kind of thing. So yeah, between creative writing and journalism and professional writing, we've got a really good core of programs and talented students who are doing it. So that's something that I'm, on one level, sorry to leave, but on the other hand, happy to see it, you know, in good shape and with good faculty and good students and good things.
It's been a pleasure working with a lot of the students from your department, both here at the radio station and my day job in IT. And I think one of the things that we see with these professional writing students is that they understand it's not writing in the abstract, it's writing to communicate something to somebody.
Right, right. And I know you run into some cases where that's not done so well with different jargon and obfuscatory wording, which always is indeed a challenge. Probably every field has jargon and vogue words, and you know, in management, it's, which we've established I'm not good at, is, you know, best practices and going forward and all these kind of buzzwords. In fact, I love, on the internet you can find these kind of buzzword bingo charts that if you go to a meeting, like a faculty meeting, it has its own thing, and any kind of business meeting, you just check off the times when people say those terms, and if you get a row, you win. Stand up and scream in the meeting or something like that.
Rachel's got a question she wants to ask you.
How long have you been doing study abroads for?
Well, since I think about 5 years before I started, so like 20 years or so.
So you've gone on a lot of them, and you're still going to be going on some.
I am.
Yeah, which is exciting.
Right. It's such a great program and opportunity for me and students. So yeah, I'm going to be doing one in London, which was the first one I did on the British press this summer, and then the second time, as you were with me in Australia this past January, so in January 2018.
Do you feel that there are benefits to teaching in that kind of setting versus just in the classrooms at the university, or how is it different?
You know, just by far the benefit is, I think, for students to be experiencing that country and that culture. And over the years, as I've done it, I've tried to develop the classes so that that becomes a part of it. It's a thing that students almost universally say was like a great experience, one of the best I've had. The only negative about it is that it's quite expensive. And so it becomes one of these things like an unpaid internship where some students can't really afford to do it. And so the ones who have the most means have the more of a chance to do it. And I know they do have scholarships, but there's a limited amount available. So that's the one thing that is not so great. It's been a really great thing to me that I'm really excited to continue and continue my association with the University of Delaware, which has been a great association. So I'm still won't officially retire, won't walk out that door till January 2018. I'm on sabbatical leave for the next year, so I'll be around. And
what kinds of things do you find that students pick up when they study abroad? I mean, do they?
I mean, nothing in particular, but I do have the experience of being a little surprised about their sophisticated understanding of the culture. Like, I think you guys, you sort of spread out and met people in Australia.
Oh yeah, we did so many things.
I think you really got a sense of the sort of culture there and the way people, like the language and the sort of aggressive friendliness.
Like sometimes it's so suspicious people to Americans, because they're like, people can't be this nice.
Right. And that's like a real part of their thing. It's like the mate culture, very egalitarian. I did a couple of study abroads in the beautiful city of Cortona in Tuscany. And students really got to know the Native people, became friendly with them, went on trips with them. It really, at that age, you know, I was really shy and wouldn't have been able to imagine doing something like that. And that's another thing from the get-go I felt about students here, that they are in many ways quite mature socially, which is, you know, definitely a good thing. And even in, you know, as I said, I kind of feel that they don't have the sort of knowledge base and vocabulary base that you pick up from reading. On the other hand, their sense of people and picking up on people and sophisticated sense of observations has been an impressive thing.
What have been some other things you've noticed as students? Have they changed in the 24 years you've been teaching here?
Yeah, I mean, maybe less than you might expect. I mean, in terms of writing, a lot of times people say, oh, students must be writing, you know, texting abbreviations in their assignments and their work, like, you know, BRB, be right back, or whatever it is. But I've actually literally never encountered that. Again, part of their sophistication, they understand that there's different registers for different things. So no major sea changes. You know, our students at UD, they tend to be bright, pretty motivated, a little bit passive. So that was another, a little bit of a rude awakening that I walked into my first classroom and I thought they were going to be shouting out questions and challenging me. And they tend to want to sit there until kind of you draw them out. And I've learned to sort of accept that over the years. And let me ask you about that, Rachel. What's your sense of the sort of culture of University of Delaware students on that issue of talking and participating in a classroom situation?
I feel like I'm kind of an outlier because I just like don't really stop talking in class half the time.
That's not true, because I've had people that don't stop talking and you're not one of them. So tell me more about the idea of being an outlier and what the deal was with the others.
A lot of times, I mean, you're right, there's kind of an apathy in the classroom. In the classrooms that I've seen, students usually think someone else is going to raise their hand and ask a question. Even if they're wondering something, they're hoping someone else will address it. I really wish I knew the answer to that. A lot of times, I would say, like, especially this year, I'm one of the first people to raise my hand in a class, and I've always been like that. I've been trying to wait longer, and, like, usually I think if you just let there be, like, an awkward silence for a little bit, the people who don't usually talk will end up talking.
Well, that's funny because that was my first strategy, and I found they could wait me out longer than I could wait them out. But I do try that sometimes. I had once had a student say to me who did, you know, was a great contributor and participator. I think she actually apologized, but she said something to the effect that when you talk a lot in class, you get a bad reputation among the other students, like you're currying favor with the teacher or something like that. I thought was like really unfortunate. And
I don't think that's the case. To be honest, I think a lot of students have anxiety about talking in class. I think anxiety is like a huge issue. And that's another reason why I've been trying to hold off, because I think a lot of people are on the verge of saying something
right,
and then like
right.
someone else will say something. But I think especially nowadays, students are so afraid to be wrong or...
Really?
Yeah.
How come?
I don't know.
I mean, it's a natural human thing, but yeah. You're saying especially nowadays?
I don't know. I think that there is an increased pressure on students to achieve greater things,
okay.
They say.
Interesting.
Where's that pressure coming from? Is it that you all have enormous student loans?
Yeah.
So it better be worth it?
And the job market being tough.
The prospect of like...
Yeah.
The looming factor of getting a job in 6 months.
So you sort of want to do everything right.
Yeah, because we are told that you have to do very specific things in order to make ends meet after you graduate,
right.
Or else you'll end up a waitress at a dive bar for the rest of your life.
Or for at least a year, which would be a great experience. But,
yeah.
You know, it's too bad. A word that I've sort of thought about in the last few years in regards to teaching and being a student is luxury.
Mm.
And... You know, I feel that in a way it's a luxury to be here and to be in a classroom. For me, getting to talk about things I'm interested in to people who are presumably interested. And for students, like, you know, if you're taking a journalism class here, say, in the real world, there's fake news and the sort of sleazy infomercials that are so-called news funded by companies. And there's a lot of really bad stuff being done in the commercial world. But here, there's the luxury of being able to try to do just good work. And I feel that that can actually be a good thing, without a doubt, for students, because if they do write something and it's published in the review or elsewhere, it's a great calling card. But it is too bad to think that students feel those constrictions of the commercial world even before they have to.
As Rachel was talking, I was trying to think back to our classrooms different now in the 20-teens compared to, you know, first time I was in a classroom teaching, you know, in the late 1970s. And I think I've always sensed student anxiety, but I think Rachel's right. I think there is more now.
You don't remember the movie The Paper Chase?
I've heard of it, but don't remember.
You do, right? Professor Kingsfield, who was the Harvard Law professor played by John Houseman. And I never went to law school, but I understand that that's the way it's done, that he not only calls them people, but sort of challenges them and makes them back things up. And, you know, for me, it's always been a kinder, gentler Professor Kingsfield that I want them to answer the question. But, and sometimes when I do that, you know, this starts a good discussion. Sometimes it's a little bit shocking that they can't answer these easy questions I'm posing. Another issue with the participation and the whole passivity thing is the laptops and, you know, cell phone devices, and kind of gone back and forth on that. I think what I ended up doing in this last class that I taught that Rachel was in is say no laptops, no open laptops, unless we're, you know, looking at a document together. You know, whether you're taking notes or looking at Facebook or whatever it is you're doing, it is takes the attention away from what's going on in the moment.
That's got to be one thing that you've noticed a change in, is the technology in the classroom that the students are using.
And no doubt, and it's, again, on the whole, a big plus. When I do journalism, I teach journalism classes. I'm constantly projecting what's going on in different news sites, for the BBC and NPR and New York Times, comparing them. I guess when that first really hit was on the day of 9/11, which was the New York Times, nytimes.com had gone up only like 2 or 3 years mm-hmm. earlier. But actually, it was not that different then from the way it is now. And in the journalism class that morning, we kind of followed along on the website. And it was, I think, a memorable experience for the students. It certainly was for me, seeing it be updated with the latest news. And it's the whole technology has been, you know, state the obvious, a revolution in many things, but certainly including information and journalism and writing.
Now we've got a 24-hour news cycle.
When a public official would have something he had to say but was embarrassing, they would always do it like after deadline.
Right.
So it wouldn't get into the next day's paper. And now you can't do that because, as you say, it's 24/7. It's like that old Woody Allen joke. The one woman's complaining that the food's bad, and the other one says, yeah, and the portions are so small. You know, it's tough to get a job in journalism, but when you do, you have to work much harder than before because, essentially, you're always on call. It's like a doctor. So those former students who are in journalism, they've got a much tougher job than it used to be in the old days, when you can kind of, you know, deadline comes, it's quitting time, pack up and go to the bar.
One of the things I've noticed with your teaching is, and a lot of the students have talked about that, is you're very curious about what students are doing, which is different, I would say, from other professors. A lot, especially in the journalism major, we get those people who are experienced journalists, and they're like, the field is changing, you're not going to get a job. But you've always expressed like a curiosity of all the new things, you know? I notice like sometimes students will use slang or language that is distinctly from a certain generation, and you're always expressing interest towards that. Is that something that you have students to thank for, or is that something you'd already be interested in?
You know, I think a great thing about the job for me is having the opportunity to work with young people and students that I didn't have before. I was an editor, so I'd work with people on a one-to-one basis. I think I am curious about people, which immodestly is probably the most important quality for a good journalist, maybe even a good writer. And so, yeah, I am curious. And language, slang being one of the things I'm always been interested in. So I remember in this class, the first day we went around the room and people introduced themselves and all that. There's a student named Kushal. And he said, well, I'm called Kush. But, you know, no pun intended, and I get a lot of jokes about that. I had no idea what he was talking about. Do you know what he was talking about?
Kush is slang for marijuana.
I had no idea. Yeah, right. So that was interesting.
Yet everyone in the class was giggling.
Yeah, learning stuff like that.
You said in your, if you will, farewell article in the Review, that your writing has really been affected by your teaching and by your interaction with your students.
Yeah. Since starting here, I've written, I guess, 4 books about writing and or language. And having to teach writing, I guess I've always been a little bit analytical, but having to teach it, as Samuel Johnson said about the prospect of being hanged in the morning, concentrated my mind wonderfully and made me think about it and kind of figure out why I thought this was good and that was bad. And that led to these books. I'm not sure it's affected made me a better writer or otherwise, but certainly in terms of things interested in and things to write about, it's
yeah,
had
the
a
topics.
Big effect. Topics.
Yeah, yeah.
You kind of reverse that too. I mean, you didn't start teaching until you were an experienced writer. Do you think that made you better at teaching, or do you think you could have started teaching sooner?
I don't think I could have started sooner. I think it's not naturally, you talk about people having anxiety and shyness. I wouldn't exactly say I'm shy, but I think I'm a natural introvert. So it's not natural for me to go into a class and communicate with people. I think having done what I did in journalism and freelance writing for 15, 16 years, that gave me the confidence to go in and teach. So it was definitely important. If I had come in my 20s, I was still that kind of immature, shy kid, and it probably would have been a disaster.
Grammar. I never learned that very well until I had to teach undergraduate students writing. I mean, I couldn't just say wordy. I had to explain.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of thing.
It's a challenge. I mean, I write about grammar. I was an editor, sort of a copy editor, so I definitely have a sense of those things. But I don't know that well the terminology. I have people all over the world like writing me with questions, like learning English. Is it correct to say, so this guy from India emailed me the other day and said, is it correct to say he's better than me or he's better than I? And I said, both. Then he followed up and said, oh, okay. Is that because than is a conjunction in that sentence? I said, I'm out. I don't know. but then when he said conjunction, that kind of threw me for a loop because I had no idea what he was talking about. And this is from a man who's written a book about the parts of speech. So
that should make everyone feel better.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know I used to tell my students, you know, when we have these grammar rules, it's not because they're morally set in stone, but it's trying to help you see what you need to do with your prose so it doesn't alienate anyone and are more inclined to
believe
find you, believable.
Listen to you, read you. Yeah, that's part of it. I often compare it to like a first date or a psychoanalytic session. The reader-writer interplay is very complicated. You don't want to overdo it and be pandering to them by never challenging them. On the other hand, you don't want to alienate them by using words they don't know and for no reason, or, as you say, mistakes in grammar and certainly not spelling or word usage either.
That's something I've definitely learned in the writing major. I would say the writing major itself has been very unexpected because I came in, I was a thesaurus junkie, you know. And then you come to realize what's the point of writing something if people aren't going to understand what you're saying.
That's junkie, not- enthusiast, aficionado. Yeah. I totally feel for students, I have the sense that when they're writing a English lit paper or a history paper, political science, they get praised for big words and long sentences. And so journalism is the opposite, and I think it's helpful for them. And there's a value to academic writing when it's done well. It's different from journalistic writing. It should never be needlessly lengthy. No, it's a never-ending task and challenge, and it's always interesting.
We've been chatting with Professor Ben Yagoda of the University of Delaware, who has taught his last class at the university in December 2016.
On campus.
But will still be taking students abroad through 2017 and 2018. And Rachel Curry, thank you very much for coming in to help us interrogate Yagoda-san.
You're the first person who ever taught me to interview someone, and here I am asking you questions.
The shoe is on the other foot.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.